Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. And as a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, Mary, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Workshop, What's New in Men's Health. Very important topic, and it's a new topic. We haven't offered this topic before, and so you're in for a lot of interesting and helpful information. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and a number of other cancer organizations. And it is because of that collaboration that we have reached so many of you. We have on the call today over 583 participants. So there are many of you on the call. It's a large call, and you come from all over the United States, from all different states in the United States, all different regions of the United States, and we also have international participants from Australia, Brazil, Canada, Kenya, East Africa, Korea, Mexico, the Philippines, Venezuela, and the United Arab Emirates. You really come from all over the world and truly are a group of information seekers. I would like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials is information about our speakers, and there also is information about all the different collaborating organizations as helpful resources for each of you. Now, there is also an evaluation form, and I would ask you to each take a moment and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us the topics you want us to offer? Indeed, today's topic, What's New in Men's Health, is one that many of you have in your evaluations indicated that it's a topic that you'd like to hear more about, the interface of different health issues that men may be experiencing, that you may be experiencing. So we hope that this helps you and that you'll tell us what you think and other topics you'd like us to offer. And we have, and today's program was made possible by an educational grant from CentiCor OrthoBiotech, Inc., and Friends of Cancer Care. And I really want to thank them for their support of this program. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to start by introducing our first speaker is Dr. David Slotsky. Dr. Slotsky is Assistant Professor of Medicine, Division of Cardiovascular Medicine, Vanderbilt Heart and Vascular Institute, Vanderbilt University Medical Center. Dr. Slotsky is going to address overview of men's health, guidelines for screening, and management of chronic conditions. Dr. Slotsky?
Good afternoon. Thank you. I'd like to, as Carolyn mentioned, I'd like to give an overview of some of the general issues related to men's health, specifically related to cardiovascular disease. And I'll give a general outline of issues that we deal with on a regular basis. And then in the second part of the conference, we will have time for questions. So the overview of this field generally relates to things like cardiovascular disease and atherosclerosis. Atherosclerosis is where there is an abnormal buildup of plaque and cholesterol and other material in arteries, and those arteries can be in different locations of the body. Atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, as it's called, is common in the general population, and it affects the majority of adults over the age of 60 years, period. As a diagnostic category, cardiovascular disease includes four major areas. Coronary heart disease, which is involvement in the arteries to the heart, which can be the manifestations of which can be a heart attack or what we call a myocardial infarction. Angina pectoris, which is a syndrome where patients have chest discomfort as a result of the blockage. Congestive heart failure and sudden cardiac death. Other areas that can be involved, which I'm not going to focus specifically on, relate to cerebrovascular disease, which can manifest by stroke. There is peripheral arterial disease, which manifested by a blockage in the lower extremities or the kidneys or other arteries in the lower part of the body and can develop ischemia or reduction in blood flow in those areas. The last category is atherosclerosis involving the aorta, which can manifest as an aneurysm either in the abdomen or the chest. The presence of atherosclerotic disease in these territories increases the likelihood of disease in other distributions. So if a patient has a blockage in a certain area of the heart, it's not unlikely that this disease can manifest in other locations. The fact that a patient or an individual will have vascular disease, it carries a consideration that they're at risk for events that I described previously. For example, if someone has a blockage in an artery to their neck, then they also have a likelihood of a blockage in their heart, and subsequent evaluation may revolve around evaluating that. To mention diabetes, diabetes is a disease where there's an abnormality in metabolism, and diabetes is now considered what we call a risk equivalent, meaning that if a patient has diabetes, that their risk of heart disease is the same as someone who already has heart disease. The prevalence of heart, and I'm going to focus now primarily on heart disease or coronary heart disease, as it's called. The prevalence of coronary heart disease is about half of the total cardiovascular disease burden. So 50% of patients that have vascular disease will have coronary heart disease. There have been many studies that have looked at this. The most famous study was called the Framingham Heart Study, which looked at patients and did a longitudinal evaluation of the incidence of coronary heart disease. The lifetime risk of developing heart disease for individuals age 40 to 49 in men, the lifetime risk for individuals at age 40 was about 49% in men. Even those who were free of disease at age 70 had a lifetime risk of approximately 35%. So there was a continuous risk of development of this disease. And a lot of that risk varied depending on the type of risk factors or factors that were associated with the predisposition to heart disease, which I'll talk about later. When we talk about risk factors, a risk factor is an entity at which, as I mentioned just a moment ago, predisposes the patient to heart disease. It doesn't mean that the patient has heart disease, but there's a higher likelihood that they have it or will develop this over time. And what we like to do is classify these risk factors as either modifiable or non-modifiable. Many of the risk factors for heart disease are modifiable by preventative measures. For example, cigarette smoking is a risk factor. That's certainly something that's modifiable. Cholesterol, what we call lipidemia, dyslipidemia, which is an elevation of the lipids or fats in the blood, that certainly is treatable with medication and lifestyle changes. High blood pressure is certainly treatable. Diabetes. And then there's an entity which you'll hear a lot in the lay press now called the metabolic syndrome. And it has to do with a number of factors, including levels of cholesterol and triglycerides, which are another fat in the blood, abdominal obesity, which is one of the hallmarks of this syndrome, where there's a central or mid-abdominal or an abdominal obesity, that sort of thing. One of our other speakers will be talking about exercise and regular physical activity, et cetera. But there are obviously multiple risk factors, and we try to modify the ones that we're able to. Certainly genetics at this point, or family history, is a very strong risk factor, but seems to be at this point not something that we can modify tremendously. Now, the predictive value, when you have a risk factor for heart disease, there are different models and different tools that we use to use that to identify, not only identify the risk factors, but use them to assess the risk for the patient, and that can be done by your physician. And that allows us to have information that we use in both the decision-making process and also the management process for that particular patient. Now, individuals with the characteristics that I'm going to describe are at risk for heart disease. First would be patients who have established heart disease, someone who's had a previous heart attack or some type of cardiac event. I mentioned diabetes mellitus. Chronic kidney disease, for example, can be a risk for patients for development of cardiovascular disease, and then the lipids that I mentioned. We actually have a program that was developed years ago through the National Institutes of Health, and it was called the National Cholesterol Education Program. And there was actually an expert panel that was utilized at that time, or really developed, and they developed guidelines over the years for evaluation and treatment of patients that had high cholesterol or high lipids. And these are published guidelines, and again, very readily available for your doctor so that they can not only identify the risk but help you manage these types of problems. I'm going to move on. Excuse me. I'm going to move on in terms of screening. Now, when we talk about any type of disease, whether it be coronary heart disease or breast cancer or other types of malignancies, there are many types of tests and things that we can do to evaluate the patients in terms of screening. One interesting thing that's been found in heart disease is that because of screening and early detection, early treatment and early management of patients with heart disease, the mortality or the death rate or the sickness rate from coronary heart disease has fallen over the past 40 to 50 years, which is very encouraging. Many people ask, well, if I do this, will it change what happens to me? And we have a lot of evidence that there is a significant impact based on early detection. In addition to that, there's a considerable interest in our society now, certainly regarding the diagnosis of coronary heart disease. If someone is asymptomatic, if someone's not having a symptom of a blockage, can the test be done to make this diagnosis? And there are a number of screening tests that are available. Again, we try to stratify the risk that someone has based on their history, their physical examination, their family history, that sort of thing. But we have, excuse me, both laboratory and imaging techniques for screening. One of the techniques that's evolved that I think is very interesting, and you will hear a great deal about again in the lay literature, has to do with specific imaging techniques using CAT scanning. And a CAT scan is an X-ray device that allows us to look at the arteries more clearly. And there are techniques now where we can identify if there's a buildup of plaque in the coronary arteries. The major test that's used for coronary screening is called the coronary calcium scan, and it's a very brief CAT scan with very little radiation that allows, if the artery has plaque buildup, which we actually can't see on X-ray, but calcium can go with that plaque, then by scanning for the calcium, we can actually visualize whether there's any buildup in the artery. And what's happened over the years is that people have developed scoring systems based on the amount of buildup, and this allows us to at least make the diagnosis and make stronger recommendations for the patient in terms of how they should be evaluated for that problem. So we have the ability to identify someone's risk at this time. We have the ability to perform screening examinations that allow us to identify whether the patient has the disease, and that may influence the decision-making process of your physician in terms of subsequent therapy. Even, for example, if your cholesterol is within a normal range, then even if that's the case and you have a buildup already, then the physician may want to recommend that you be on therapy that would not be recommended if they didn't have the different tools available to them. So I think that becomes very important. Once the diagnoses are made, then it allows the physician the opportunity to proceed with the decision-making process. And I want to bring this up. I think it's a very important point. The communication, the patient may be seen by a number of different people for these types of examinations. It may begin with the internist or the family physician, and then a referral may be made to the cardiologist. But ultimately, there is a significant need that we have for communication between the various physicians involved in this area so that the doctors can you know, for lack of a common word, be on the same page and be able to determine the appropriate diagnostic and therapeutic interventions for the patient, because these diseases are chronic diseases. We can make them better, we can improve them, but these are not diseases that we actually cure. It's like high blood pressure. Generally, people that have high blood pressure will have high blood pressure and require treatment indefinitely. There are certainly some people that have high blood pressure that can lose weight and can exercise and modify their lifestyle, and their blood pressure may return to normal. But in general, these are chronic diseases that require co-management with the physicians involved and significant communication. So that's an overview of the general health aspects of cardiovascular disease. There will be some questions that we can discuss specifically, and we can talk about some of the manifestations of heart disease that occur, heart attack and things like that, as the question and answer period proceeds. But that will conclude my remarks at this point.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Slavsky, for just a wonderful overview and really for setting the tone for really the context of really people understanding about the management of chronic illness and how that is very effectively done, and just some of the important things people to be aware of in terms of the communication between physicians and the people involved. So thank you so much. Our next speaker is Dr. Susan Slovin. Dr. Slovin is Associate Attending Physician, Genitourinary Oncology Service, Sidney Kimmel Center for the Treatment of Prostate and Urologic Cancers, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. She's also Associate Professor of Medicine, Department of Medicine, Weill College of Cornell University. Dr. Slovin is going to really focus on prostate cancer, including current standard of care and new treatment options. She will also discuss the role of clinical trials and the importance of communicating with your healthcare team. My pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Slovin.
Thank you, Carolyn, and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Once again, I'm facing time constraints and trying to address everybody's needs, but I think it was very refreshing that we had Dr. Slavsky on board here to really reinforce the fact that all doctors should be talking to one another, and it's pivotal that we share common findings regarding patients, whether it's the treatment, the medications they're on, or just to touch base. So I'm glad we've been able to make that point. Once again, it's very hard to address every possible avenue of prostate cancer. I will spend a lot of time discussing treatments in the metastatic setting, but I'm just going to review for everybody in a very brief way the standard therapies that are out there for patients with organ-confined, newly diagnosed disease, patients who have had their PSA return, what we call a biochemical relapse, and subsequently patients who have metastatic disease. We've really had a banner year for prostate cancer. There are new drugs that are out there. Granted, they are for different times of the disease state, but nevertheless, they're new, they're exciting, and they offer many alternatives for patients and will allow patients to what we hope will hopefully be longer survival. So starting at the very beginning, for patients who have an elevated PSA and what we know to have as a organ-confined disease, meaning that the disease has not been shown to escape the confines of the prostate, standard treatment options include surgery, and that surgery comes in many flavors these days, including open surgery, or what we call radical prostatectomy, laparoscopic prostatectomy, as well as robotic prostatectomy. And I think the biggest confusion and media hype has been when patients are hearing about the robotic approach. You don't have R2-D2 walking around in the operating room, just the opposite. Robotic surgery is really an extension of laparoscopic surgery. Laparoscopic surgery itself is really a means of using instrumentation as well as the hands to minimize the amount of surgery that's done externally, but still accomplish the complete removal of the prostate, the seminal vesicles, and the lymph nodes, which is what would occur during standard open radical prostatectomy. Robotic offers no other advantage in the sense that you are still having the same number of lymph nodes removed, the same organs that are being removed, but it does provide a higher magnification for the physician who is working on the patient. There does not need to be direct patient contact, and the physician works at a console, allowing him to have the dexterity through mechanical arms to perform surgery. Outcome for all of these is the same. We have a goal of achieving a PSA of less than 0.05 and hopefully no further recurrence of the PSA. All of them are safe. There are different side effect profiles, with the laparoscopic and robotic offering really a minimal hospitalization of at least 24 to maximum of 48 hours. Radiation also comes in two different types for patients who might be older and are not surgical candidates or have other medical comorbidities where the risk of surgery may lead to postoperative complications. Radiation therapy offers a very safe alternative. Whether or not hormonal therapy can be given with radiation really depends on the grade or of the cancer's aggressiveness, what we call the Gleason score. So for patients who have a higher grade Gleason score of 8, 9, or 10, most doctors would be recommending that they receive hormonal therapy followed by radiation, which is usually 5 days per week for a total of 8 weeks, and additional hormonal therapy for anywhere from 2 to 3 years thereafter. The combination of what we call seed implants or brachytherapy with external beam radiation is usually selected for patients with perhaps, again, high levels of aggressiveness in their tumor, but maybe larger cancers where giving just seeds alone may be insufficient. Seed implants can also be used for patients with very small glands, PSAs that are well under 10, and Gleason grades or scores that are much lower, so less aggressive. And these are usually accompanied by very durable responses. So what's very interesting, what people tend to forget, is you still have your prostate. And therefore, the PSA will not go down to zero, but will remain at a value of less than decimal 0.5. Side effects of radiation, just like the side effects of surgery, are variable. Some people have no side effects. Others may have many, but I think it really depends on the level or the extensiveness of the surgery or the radiation that's performed. It is not guaranteed that you will be incontinent of urine with surgery. It is not guaranteed you will have erectile dysfunction. In fact, just the opposite. Most patients by 6 months have minimal loss of urine, maybe when they sneeze or cough, just the way a woman who's had a baby might have right after delivery. Similarly, for patients who've had radiation therapy, there's no difficulty with urination, but occasionally somebody might experience a little bit of bright red blood in their urine or in their rectum. It's perfectly normal. It won't hurt them in any way, but overall patients do very well, and these are both procedures, both surgery and radiation, that are safe and well proven throughout the years. Where it gets a little bit more challenging is when patients who have already had surgery and radiation therapy, or both, and have a rising PSA. And we saw the evolution of this very unique subclass of patients roughly in the early 1990s. These were usually younger men who have had surgery or radiation or both and had just the only manifestation of disease as a rise in PSA, what we now term a biochemical relapse. For patients like this, there really is no standard of care. And what I'm saying is that patients have rising PSAs in the absence of any disease that we can see on a bone scan or CAT scan. When we see this, really depending on the level of aggressiveness of the tumor or how fast the PSA is rising, meaning is it doubling or tripling in less than 6 months or 3 months, we may elect not to do anything for the patient. In fact, for patients who have a rising PSA post-surgery, for example, if there's evidence of disease at the surgical margins or into the prostatic capsule or even a little bit beyond, we are now using radiation therapy to the prostate bed, the area where the prostate had been, as a treatment with some very good responses. We're not talking about prolonging survival with this treatment. We're talking about essentially taking care of the disease that still may be remaining within the confines of the prostate bed, which will ultimately lead to long-term durability of their response. Similarly, for patients who have gone through this already and their PSA is rising, there will be some cases where giving hormonal therapy on an intermittent basis may be reasonable. This is a perfect venue for patients to go on investigational trials, because whatever investigational trial can be used may actually alter the overall biology or the behavior of the cancer in months or years to come. So while there are no standards available, further discussion with your medical oncologist or urologist is absolutely appropriate, and referral to investigational procedures and trials would also be very reasonable. Remember, one can always go on standard therapy if a standard therapy exists, but having the opportunity to change the biology and impact on the cancer is, I think, of paramount importance. Now, for patients who present with metastatic disease at the time of diagnosis or have failed surgery or radiation or both, the progression of disease to bone or lymph node or other structures is usually addressed by hormonal therapy. The goal is to starve the cancer of testosterone, which feeds the cancer. And, of course, this is a therapy that has been around for many, many years. Side effects can, but are not often going to include, some hot flushes because you go through what we consider to be a chemical-induced menopause. Some men may have breast enlargement, nipple tenderness, mood swings, feeling a little low or a little more tearful. There may be some osteoporosis that's accelerated, for which we always recommend that going through a baseline bone mineral density or DEXA scan would be very reasonable. Patients may put on some weight, and Dr. Slosky alluded to the initiation of what we call a metabolic syndrome, where cholesterol may or may not rise. There may be a change in the body's distribution where the breasts look a little bit fuller, and you get a little bit of a pot belly. And again, I want to stress that not all of these side effects can occur. In fact, I have many a patient who has absolutely no side effects as a result of being on a hormonal regimen. But at least I think in the majority of patients, if they have anywhere from 0 to 1 or 2 side effects, all very manageable, all very tolerable, does not prevent people from going on vacation, celebrating, doing things, or going to work. Our biggest challenge now is what happens when people do not respond to their therapies. We often like to use an anti-androgen, such as bicalutamide, in addition to a GnRH analog called Lupron or Zoladex or Trelstar. There are a lot of these out there. They're all very safe and FDA approved. However, if the combination of the bicalutamide or whatever the oral antiandrogen is no longer works along with the injection, one can often change to another one within the same class or another antiandrogen or adrenal suppressant agent so that you can actually go through 3 or 4 different pill manipulations really before you have been considered to fail hormonal therapy. So hormonal refractoriness is not what we call anymore. We call that the hormone resistance, which means you're really resistant to one agent and that there are other agents to which you can very successfully and for long term respond. Now, if none of these work, what's out there? Well, I personally use 3 criteria for making a decision as to whether or not one should go on to chemotherapy. Chemotherapy is the bad C word. We used to think that cancer was the C word. It's chemo that causes rivulets of sweat to pour people down people's backs. Reality is that chemotherapy has improved quality of life. It has improved survival. It has actually improved pain and has become one of the mainstays of our treatment of prostate cancer. People rather erroneously think that if you're going on chemotherapy, that means it's end of life. Au contraire, in fact, we use chemotherapy in selected cases before the patient goes on to prostatectomy. I sometimes will use it if I find that the PSA is not responding fast enough or if disease in a particular site is not regressing fast enough, so I may stop one of the hormonal manipulations and immediately go to chemo with the idea that I can go back and use other hormonal manipulations later on. So for me, a PSA that's been doubling or tripling so quickly that I can't get a good handle on it with hormonal manipulation would be exactly the scenario where I would start chemotherapy. And the standard of care is a drug called docetaxel or Taxotere. If a patient is not thriving, they loss of appetite, they're tired, they have some pain, that would be another scenario. And the third scenario is a patient who has such rapid disease progression that I might have to radiate so many different areas in their body that I would be impacting on their bone marrow reserves. And for that, giving chemotherapy will spare the bone marrow, improve quality of life, hopefully impact on the disease as we know it will and has been shown to do so, and also take away pain. So there's a lot of things that are out there. What's really very exciting is the fact that even if today we are failing the standard chemotherapy, Taxotere or docetaxel, There is now a new FDA-approved second-line chemotherapy called cabazitaxel. The other name for it is Gevtana, J-E-V-T-A-N-A, and that has been shown to improve survival as well as improve quality of life in patients who have failed docetaxel. There are several new drugs out there in addition to Gevtana in the second-line post-chemotherapy setting. Many of you may have heard about Provenge by the Dendreon Corporation. It is a cellular product immune therapy whereby patients' white blood cells are removed and are incubated with a prostate fusion protein against the prostatic acid phosphatase molecule. The cells are then expanded in culture and are returned within 48 hours to the patient and given intravenously. It has been shown to have a 4-month survival benefit with minimal impact on PSA and disease. That's not to say that it has not done so in some patients, but the majority of patients do not seem to have very significant change in their actual disease. But again, it's still in its early research, but it is FDA approved and has been shown to improve survival. Another drug that's been out there that is likely going to be approved is an oral drug called abiraterone, A-B-I-R-A-T-E-R-O-N-E. This is a drug that bears striking similarity to a drug that's been used for the last 25 years in prostate cancer called ketoconazole. The other name for it is Nizoral, N-I-Z-O-R-A-L. Many of you may know Nizoral, as Nizoral is an antifungal drug that works not at the level of a molecule on the tumor cell called the androgen receptor, but at the level of the adrenal glands. We all have adrenal glands. They're tiny little lima bean-shaped organs, one on top of each kidney, and they allow us to interact with our environment. They allow us to moderate our blood pressure, our sugars, or the steroids that we need for energy. It also produces, the little organ produces estrogen and testosterone, which are the sex steroids, as well as allowing us to produce adrenaline, which is the hormone for fight or flight. So what this drug, ketoconazole, does is that it prevents or poisons the chemical machinery within the adrenal gland that makes a little bit of the extra testosterone that could be floating in your circulation. Abiraterone has been shown to work in patients who have failed prior ketoconazole and also have failed other therapies, such as even chemotherapy. So it's going to be likely FDA approved. It's shown significant benefit and is currently available on clinical trials in the post-chemotherapy setting, but it is going to be fast-tracked to the FDA. Another drug that's out there is similar to that of Casodex, but a lot more specific and more potent, called MDV-3100 by the Medivation company. And this, too, has been shown to be very efficacious in patients who have failed other hormones as well as other chemotherapy. So you can appreciate the fact that there are just so many new and wonderful things there. Now, that being said, does not mean that one should forestall going on to investigational trials. I'm a very firm believer that investigational trials are very important to people because it can impact on the cancer and change the cancer's biology. People are erroneously of the sentiment that all an investigational trial does is takes a drug that's never been seen and given to patients as if they were guinea pigs. Hardly the case. Many times these are drugs that have been already evaluated by the FDA, but they're given on novel schedules, given with novel approaches in combination. And believe it or not, in breast cancer, the breast cancer patients probably have the highest accrual to clinical trials compared to any other disease. It's interesting how two hormonally driven diseases can be so different, where there is such less accrual inferior accrual in patients with prostate compared with women who are on breast. And frankly, if we didn't have all these wives involved, I don't think we would even get as much done as we do with patients thus far. There are other things to be aware of is that we always want to worry about bone health, and I believe Dr. Pinto will be talking about the role of exercise. But two drugs have been used routinely in prostate cancer. One is a drug called Zometa, Z-O-M-E-T-A. It's a bisphosphonate, which is a class of drugs that has been shown to delay the time to skeletal events. And what we mean by skeletal events is loss of height of the vertebrae due to cancer, what we call compression fracture or the progression of disease on the cord called a cord compression. Well, the FDA has also approved another drug called denosumab. The other name for it is Xgeva. That was originally for postmenopausal women with osteoporosis with high risk of fracture. This is a drug that's a little bit different in the way it behaves because it's a monoclonal antibody. It's not a bisphosphonate. It binds to a particular molecule called RANK, R-A-N-K, ligand, and it's designed to interrupt the cascade of molecular events leading to bone metastasis. And it can be used in patients who have kidney problems, whereas there are some limitations in Zometa. And really, is one really better than the other? And I think it has to be done on a case-by-case basis where your doctor makes a decision whether it's right for you. We do know that denosumab was a little bit better, not by much, but a little bit better in the time to the first skeletal event, a difference of maybe 41% versus 36%. Both are very safe. Both have a role in prostate cancer. However, I believe the decision as to which one will benefit you really needs to be made between you and your physician. So let me reiterate that this is a very, very exciting time that we're in now for prostate cancer with a lot more selections for treating patients and keeping patients alive a lot longer. Thank you. Back to you, Carol.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Slovin. Just an excellent, so very comprehensive presentation. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Really lots of wonderful information. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Bernadine Pinto. Dr. Pinto is professor of research at the Miriam Hospital and the Warren Albert Medical School of Brown University, Centers for Behavioral and Preventive Medicine. Dr. Pinto has spoken on a number of other programs before, and she's going to focus on the importance of physical activity. Dr. Pinto?
Thanks, Carolyn. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm very glad to have this opportunity to talk to you all about exercise and its relevance to men's health. So my thanks to Dr. Messner for inviting me. Today, I'd like to share with you my view of what we know about the benefits of exercise for men, particularly for those who are at risk for cardiovascular disease or those who have been diagnosed with cardiovascular disease. I will also be talking about new and exciting information about exercise for men diagnosed with prostate cancer and how exercise might help in recovery. I'll describe the type of exercise that has been recommended and end with some tips on how to get started and how to motivate yourself to become active. So first, let's start with exercise and the risk for cardiovascular disease. We've known for many years that exercise can help strengthen the heart muscle, reduce blood pressure, and can keep the blood flowing through your body. Regular exercise actually provides a 2-1 punch for managing your cholesterol levels because it reduces triglycerides and can increase high-density lipoprotein, HDL, which is a good cholesterol. So by doing so, it can reduce the buildup of plaque in the arteries. Also, by burning calories when you exercise, you certainly can help to ward off the gain in weight that all of us experience when we grow older, and weight loss can help to reduce the cardiovascular risk. And finally, even among people who have had a cardiac event, like a heart attack, exercise has an established role to play in cardiac rehab, so it can help reduce the risk of future events. So all in all, I'd like you all to think of exercise as medicine that has very few side effects, and it's something we can do for ourselves. Moving on, let's talk about the role of exercise in the recovery from prostate cancer. For many years, most cancer patients got the recommendation that they needed to get plenty of rest. Actually, though reducing physical activity may be appropriate during treatment for those experiencing side effects, it certainly does not have to be the norm for everyone, especially after treatment ends. As some of you know, men treated for prostate cancer report difficulties such as increased weight, increased fatigue, changes in their body image and sexual functioning, anxiety, and depressed mood. And some of these problems can linger on for many months and years. And as Dr. Slovin has discussed, treatments for prostate cancer have improved, but they are sometimes accompanied by reduced fitness and strength. One of these treatments, again previously mentioned, a hormone treatment, can in time reduce lean muscle and bone mass. So over time, it can increase the risk for fractures and falls, making it difficult for people to live independently. There's also an increase in fat mass, and that increase can lead to an increase in total cholesterol and triglycerides, which in turn increases the risk for cardiovascular disease, which I talked about a few minutes ago. And exercise can help to reduce those risks. So let's answer the question about whether exercise can help men with prostate cancer. And the answer to that is it certainly can. There have been at least 12 studies that have offered exercise programs for prostate cancer patients, and we have strong evidence to support the benefits for fitness, for strength, and the reduction of fatigue. There are also benefits for improved physical functioning and for weight control, especially in preventing the gain in fat mass and maintaining or preventing a decrease in lean mass and an improvement in quality of life. Now, let me just mention the two types of exercise. We know that aerobic exercise can be beneficial. A few studies have shown among patients who are receiving radiation treatment that aerobic exercise improved their physical functioning, their fitness, their flexibility, and their quality of life, and they reported less fatigue than the men who weren't exercising. And what was also of interest was that their PSA levels didn't change significantly when they exercised. The other major form of exercise, which is resistance training or weight training, also can help. And again, studies have shown that men who took part in resistance training also reported reduced fatigue, higher quality of life, and improved strength. And so if you combine the two types of exercise, if you do both aerobic as well as strength training, you get combined benefits. Are there any side effects? In most of the studies, the men are usually carefully supervised, particularly when they are engaging in resistance exercise. So we haven't had a lot of evidence about any side effects, but there is the risk of fractures, and in these trials, men are very carefully screened before they're included in the study. So, for example, if the disease has spread to the bone, they are usually not included. Okay, so let's move on to the next question. How much exercise and what type of exercise would be beneficial? In 2008, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services issued guidelines for exercise for the public, but those guidelines also support that people with chronic conditions like cardiovascular disease or cancer should be as physically active as their health status allows. So an important takeaway message was that people should avoid inactivity. And the guidelines went on to say that it's important to get at least 150 minutes of moderate intensity aerobic exercise each week, or 75 minutes of vigorous exercise or a combination. When I say moderate intensity aerobic exercise, I mean activities like brisk walking, where you sweat a little, your heart rate increases, but you can carry on a conversation. Vigorous exercise is when your heart pumps much faster while you're running or jogging, those type of activities. And for strength training, the recommendations are that you need to exercise the major muscle groups at least 2 to 3 times a week. We're at an especially exciting time as we begin to learn more about how exercise can help in the recovery from prostate cancer. Last year, the American College of Sports Medicine sponsored a meeting where they convened the experts to review the literature on what was known about exercise for cancer patients, and they issued the very first guidelines for exercise for cancer patients. And by and large, they endorsed the U.S. Department of Health and Services recommendations. Okay, so granted that you're interested and like to exercise, how do you get started? First, I would recommend that it's best to check with your physician, could be your primary care physician or your cancer care specialist, to see if becoming active is something that would be beneficial for you, and to make sure that your exercise program is integrated with your medications, any dietary changes or other lifestyle changes. In some cases, your physician may want to refer you to physical therapy or to rehab, especially if there's some problems with balance. Your physician may want you to do an exercise stress test, especially if you have cardiovascular disease, to see if there are any risks associated with taxing your heart. And at the same time, you may want to ask your physician if there are any activities that you should avoid. And usually this might be vigorous exercise or any precautions you might need to take. So much depends on your state of health, your medical history, and your fitness level. Second, your physician may want to refer you to an exercise specialist or to a community exercise program. Or if you've had cancer, perhaps the local Y. I want to mention the YMCA specifically because in the U.S., the YMCA has launched a free 12-week aerobic and resistance training program for cancer patients. So you may want to check into that. If the Y is not available where you live, look to see if the exercise trainers in your area have certifications from the American College of Sports Medicine. I'm mentioning this because the American College of Sports Medicine is offering fitness professionals a special certification program to ensure that they have the skills to work with cancer patients effectively and safely. So the exercise specialist can help to develop a prescription for you, an exercise prescription that takes into account your level of fitness, your medical history, and the program would be tailored for your needs. Now, if your physician doesn't identify any major problem or limitation that requires you to participate in a supervised program, here are some tips to help you to become active. The first thing you want to remember is start slow. Begin by looking for small ways to increase movement in your day. Take the stairs more often rather than always looking for the elevator. Park your car further away from the stores. Even household chores like raking or cleaning windows can count as physical activity if you do them briskly. So the idea is that physical activity is not all or nothing. Do something rather than doing nothing at all. The next important point is set yourself small goals. We're not all aiming to run marathons, but your goal could be taking a brisk walk 2 or 3 times a week. Keep your goals simple, write them down, and track your progress. And I think tracking in particular is very helpful for people because it helps them to stay committed. There are tracking logs you can access on the internet, or you can keep it simple. You can just record the time you spend each day exercising on a calendar. For those of you all who are competitive, you may want to track how long it took you to walk half a mile and then see if you can improve your time. So it's kind of like a mini competition with yourself. Think about social support. Some people don't like to exercise by themselves, so look for exercise programs in your community center, or senior center, or at the Y. And the other thing is don't forget, you might have a buddy at home of the furry kind. Dogs in particular are great exercise machines, so walking your dog will be great exercise for you and also for your dog. Another important element, and this is what I often hear from people that I work with, they say, well, you know, I meant to exercise, but I forgot. So try to develop a system of reminders, whether it be your iPhone or the old-fashioned post-it notes or just writing it on your calendar so that you remember. As I mentioned before, look for resources in your community. Look to see if the local school track is something that you can use after hours. Look to see if there are exercise classes at the community center. In many places, there are walking clubs that you might join where you can meet new friends and see new areas, and at the same time, you can exercise. Now, we'd all like to exercise and keep it going, but let's be realistic. Life happens, and that can disrupt your routine, including exercise. So as much as possible, try to anticipate changes. See if you can stay active despite those types of problems. I often hear patients tell me, well, I'm going on vacation, so I can't exercise. Well, and the vacation actually can offer you new opportunities to be active rather than as a reason to stop exercising. And I just want to, before I end on these tips, I do want everyone to remember to exercise safely. So listen to your body and watch for signs of overexertion, so shortness of breath, chest pain, dizziness, breaking out in a cold sweat. If you experience any of those kinds of signs, slow down immediately and then follow up with your doctor to see if these or any other medical problems or concerns arise. And I'd like to end by mentioning again, as Dr. Slovin did, much of what the information that we have shared today came out of clinical trials of people who volunteered to take part, but there are still a lot of questions that need to be answered. So I'd like to encourage you all in the who are listening in, look for opportunities to take part in these kinds of studies. They are usually offered by researchers at colleges, universities, and medical schools. And I just want to thank you all for listening today.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Pinto. That was a wonderful presentation, and you gave something for everybody. So I think there's something that anyone on this call could take away to use and increase their physical activity. So thank you very much. And so now we do have time for questions, and we have lots of time for questions. I'm going to ask Mary to come on, explain to you how to queue up for questions. I'm going to ask her to bring all of our speakers on board, and we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. Now, with so many of you on the call, we won't be able to get to all your questions. And so please, if you don't get a chance to ask your question, just call Cancer Care at the end of the call, our 1-800-813-HOPE number, and our staff will be here to help you. Okay? Mary, could you explain to everybody how to queue up?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Our first question comes from Emil S.
Hi. I had robotic surgery. I had prostate cancer 29 months ago. I've lost 50 pounds purposely. I exercise every day. I walk. I lift hand weights. I diet with a lot of fruits and vegetables.
And did you have a question?
My question is, I just had my yearly physical, and one of my doctors, my gastro doctor, mentioned, when was the last time I had an x-ray taken? Is it important to have x-rays taken and get the extra x-rays in your body, or should you take an x-ray only when you need one?
Okay, well, Neil, thank you for that question. I'm going to ask Dr. Slovin to address your question in a general way, but it sounds like
you're
really doing
a lot. Well, it depends. Yes, thank you for your question. Of course, depends on what you mean by x-ray. I mean, we use x-ray to define a lot of things. If you're talking about a baseline chest x-ray, I would say most general practitioners may recommend that once a year as part of their routine physical that it's done, particularly in the setting of somebody who has a history of tobacco use. If you're talking about a bone scan and CAT scan, we don't usually do it for somebody whose PSA is zero unless there's a reason to be concerned about any other intercurrent issues. So I'm sorry if I'm not answering your question directly. It really depends on the scenario. But I would not be concerned about the radiation. I know there's been a lot of media hype about it. It's actually been very, very safe.
Excellent. Thank you. All right, next question, please.
Our next question comes from Arunava D.
Hi, this is Arun. Yeah, I had a simple question for cancer survivors, say, with a lymphoma over the age of 60 and with a history of CVD post-MI. Besides exercise with moderate exertion, an excellent lipid profile, controlled blood pressure with no history of metabolic syndrome or abdominal obesity with a BMI of in the low 20s.
And your question?
Non-invasive measures are there to determine coronary artery plaque formation besides a coronary calcium scan?
Okay, excellent question. I'm going to ask Dr. Slosky to address your question in a general way because the program today is focusing, of course, on men's health. And so, Dr. Slosky, if you can just identify some of the some things that might be helpful to this particular caller and everyone on the call as well, just other kinds of tests and things.
Yes, there are a number of techniques to assess whether there's any obstructive disease. Traditionally, we would use non-invasive tests such as stress testing, for example, and most of these were designed to look at the blood flow to the heart and assess whether there's blockage indirectly. So if you do a stress test or there are imaging techniques in addition to that. Sometimes we will inject a radioactive material into a vein and then take pictures of the blood flow. We have echocardiography or ultrasound that can look at the abnormalities that occur if the heart is if there's reduction of blood flow to the heart. But these are all indirect methods. The direct methods traditionally have been an angiogram or a cardiac catheterization where a tiny tube is inserted into a blood vessel and threaded up into the arteries to the heart, and then a contrast material is injected to visualize the arteries. The non-invasive form of that is the CAT scans that I described. So we have a number of different techniques. Traditionally, they've been non-invasive and relate to blood flow, and now we have the ability to actually visualize whether plaque occurs.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you very much. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from James T.
Yes, I am a prostate cancer, 56 years old. I go for the Lupron shot, and I have the urinary infection. It won't stop, and neither one will stop. And I'm just wanting to know, I exercise a lot. I just want to know if I'm doing the right thing. I'm exercising a lot, and I go for my Lupron shot, and the urinary, we take in the dioxin, we go up to 4 milligrams, and it doesn't work no more than 1 milligram. Those are my questions.
Well, thank you. Excellent question. I'm going to ask Dr. Slovin to address your question in a general way, and then we encourage you to go back to your treating healthcare team. Dr. Slovin?
Yes. I mean, I'm not sure really what the question is. I'm not sure if the question is what else could you do addition, the issues you're having with your urination. I mean, all that, unfortunately, I can't answer on a telephone. I don't really know that much about your medical history, and I would very strongly encourage you to speak to your urologist if there's some more issues with regard to the urination problems. I wish I could be more helpful than that. I'm sorry.
And infection, is that something that,
the infection can be any number of reasons. I mean, people who have recurrent infections, either maybe due because they're using catheters or they're doing self-catheterization, or they have an indwelling catheter in their penis, it's really very hard to know. There are situations whereby patients are maintained on low doses of antibiotics because their body tends to hold on to these infections and never really goes away. It's what we call being colonized by the bacteria. It's usually non-fatal, non-lethal in any way. But if this is something where you're more symptomatic, it's extremely important to figure out what is causing those symptoms, because the bacteria can certainly do it. But if you do have any sort of appliance, a nephrostomy, a catheter, you're not drinking enough water, all these can be contributing to the problem, and I would urge you very strongly to see your urologist for this problem.
Well, those are excellent recommendations, Dr. Slovin, and I hope that Colin will go back to your healthcare team. Also, of course, this infection bothers you. You want to be sure that it's treated, and so that the concept, Dr. Slovin has recommended a number of things. Perhaps you can mention those to your treating healthcare team. Well, you know, I actually want to thank our speakers and today. They were really outstanding. All of them, just an extraordinary group. Again, it was the first time we'd offered this particular theme, and I have to say we definitely want to do this again because it was really, really, they were so terrific, a wonderful team. Really representing the multidisciplinary team. They're communicating with each other on issues. Also, I want to thank you, all of you who have asked such excellent questions. You know, your questions really enhance our call. It gives our speakers a chance to elaborate on some points further. The call is about to end. We only have a minute, just a little bit of time left before the call ends. But I want you to know that although the call may be ending soon, your services that you can access from Cancer Care, those will continue really endlessly. Those don't end. And so I do want to remind you all that Cancer Care does offer a host of services. We have a staff of 60 master's level trained oncology social workers, and we're here to provide a host of services. We're here to provide all types of help in terms of practical and financial assistance, counseling services, both individuals, families, and we do group counseling over the telephone and online. We have lots of these types of programs, education workshops, and a lot of different materials and publications. So that there's many things that you can get from Cancer Care, and when in doubt, I would say call our 1-800-813-HOPE number. Visit our website, www.cancercare.org. Most importantly, as we conclude our program today, I do not want anyone to feel that you're alone in coping with cancer, with prostate cancer, with men's health issues. I want you to now feel you're part of a community of support, and we are here to help you. Cancer Care is here to help you and all the other organizations as well. But I really want to speak on behalf of Cancer Care that we really invite you to utilize these services. They're free. And we want you to feel that you're part of a supportive community. I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.